Canon Films dates all the way back to 1967, when the company was established to produce low to medium budget exploitation films. After a decade of operation as a small independent, the company ran into financial difficulties, and in 1979, it was bought by Israeli cousins Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, who'd had a great deal of success making films in Israel and were looking to break into the American market. Golan and Globus based Canon on the traditional Hollywood studio model, complete with their own stars, production company, as well as distribution arms. Their formula was to spend little money on production, to shoot quickly, and to make a lot of product. Some of their films lost money at the box office, but as long as some did well, Canon made a profit, and more films. Here's Isaac Cole, Canon's head of production in Israel, describing one of the Canon philosophies in 1986.
Well, the main secret is that all the budget, or most of the budget, 99% of the budget of a picture is going to the screen. Not with all the limousine, schmilmousine, lunches, bunches, and all this nonsense that first of all is money, and secondly, we don't have time for this. On this time that Menachem is spending few lunches, he can do another picture.
By the mid-1980s, Canon had reached its zenith, producing as many as 40 films per year. If you were going to see a film at the cinema in 1986, it is very likely that it would have been a Canon film. In the meantime, Christopher Sykes was working as a documentary filmmaker, making mostly science-themed films for BBC television. In 1986, he was asked to make a film about Canon Films, who had recently bought a large stake in the UK cinema market, sparking fears that they would flood UK cinemas with exclusively Canon product. Without knowing it at the time, and with no intention to do so, Sykes would become an unofficial film biographer of Menachem Golan, making three documentaries with him over a period of 30 years. This is the story of that relationship. This is your Doc Pod. So we're about mid-80s. I'm curious about what was your knowledge about Canon Films before you actually got this assignment?
Zero. This is the whole thing, how it came about. I, through a series of accidents, had found myself working in the science department at BBC Television for some time, but I was very attracted by arts programmes like Arena and Omnibus and so on. And I got to know Alan Yentob, who's became quite a sort of a figure in, obviously, as we know. He was running Arena at the time, and I did a film for him. I did it in holidays and weekends because I was supposed to be on the staff of the science department, a film about a war photographer called Tim Page, and we called it Mentioned in Dispatches because that's where I first came across him in Michael Howe's book. Anyway, so because of that, and Alan liked the film, and then, I can't remember exactly what happened. I left the BBC staff in 1983 because I wanted to be able to move around and work for different departments and do some science and some arts and like that, and Channel 4 and just started and so on. So I remember what happened was that I think I met Alan in the corridor, and he said, "Oh, I've been looking for you. I want you to make a film about Aaron Spelling," who at that time was... What was he, Dynasty or something, or was that what it was all about?
It was Dynasty.
Yeah, I want you to make an omnibus being the sort of BBC One main art series. And Alan, I think by now, was head of music and arts or something. And he said, "I want you to make this film about Aaron Spelling." And I said, "Well, that sounds great," because I thought, yeah, you know, I was up for this, Hollywood and all that. And I started reading about Aaron Spelling a bit. And then a couple of days later, Alan said, "Actually, we don't want you to make a film about Aaron Spelling. I was with Menachem Golan yesterday in some hotel in London or whatever, and we must make a film about Menachem Golan. He and his cousin Yoram Globus, who I'd never heard of, and I'd never heard of Canon Films, I don't think. You know, they're sort of big players, and they're doing all these amazing things, and, you know, maybe we'll be able to do some stuff with them." I think this is the important background in a funny sort of way. So make a film about Menachem Golan and Canon. And at this time, as you know, that Canon was pretty well at its sort of zenith, I suppose. I mean, they were making, I don't know, 40, 50 films a year or something, and everybody seemed to be working for them. It's really hard to find, which we'll come to, anybody who wasn't. So anyway, so that's the thing. And what was great about those days, I think unlike now, was that when Alan said, go and make a film about Menachem Golan, that's sort of what you did. I mean, you just, you read, got some press cuttings out, read up about this guy, and off you went to Los Angeles. Now, I have to say that before I was a freelance, and I did read these cuttings about Golan, and I thought, my God, you know, I mean, I don't know that I like the sound of this at all. I mean, the guy was obviously a monster, really. Well, you know, he was, you know, there were pieces written about him sort of, you know, saying, you know, I get a hard-on for Kim Basinger just watching the rushes, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But there was a much more important reason. They, at that time, had one of their big films come out called Delta Force, The Delta Force. And did I go to see it as a special showing? I think I did. I think I went to some sort of press showing. And this gave me a real problem because I'd, just a few years earlier, I'd made some films in Beirut after the Israeli invasion in Lebanon, and I'd become interested, not to say, I have to say, rather passionately sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause and their plight and everything. And so I go to see this, their latest film, it was a press showing, I remember, in London. And I see this film, The Delta Force, which is, you know, really, one way or another, is Chuck Norris and Lee Marvin kicking Palestinians to death, you know, or shooting them. And I thought, well, I don't know that I want anything to do with, you know, the man who directed this and his cousin who was the co-producer of it, or the whole thing. I mean, I thought, well, I just don't know, is this what I should be doing? Now, luckily, but as it turned out, my great friend, who's now my sort of best friend, who's a Polish-Israeli and English person, I suppose, called Vitek. I didn't know him very well at that time, but I thought, look, he's Israeli and he has been a filmmaker and he might have a view on this. What should I do? And I knew his political sympathies as well. I knew he was vaguely pro-Palestinian and so on. And I rang him up and I said, can I come and have a chat with you about this dilemma? And he said, yeah. And I said, look, I've been asked to make this film about two Israeli filmmakers, Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, and who, by the way, part of their history is they'd dominated the Israeli film industry, and they had this tremendous string of hits. I can't remember what they were called, something Popsicle, or anyway, they did all these pop, slightly sexy, coming-of-age, whatever they were called, things, and they, top of the Israeli box office, and they were immensely successful before they'd recently, I think a few years earlier, moved to Hollywood. Anyway, I told Vita, I said, look, and he goes, well, what's your problem? And I said, well, you know, I don't know that I like the sound of these guys and their politics and everything. And he said, look, let me tell you, I know about these people. He said, they're the lowest of the low. Everybody in Israel knows them. They're sort of like down there in the gutter. He said, but look, you're a filmmaker. He said, you should get down there with them and, you know, you'll have a great time. It can't fail to be interesting and probably very funny. Well, so that was sort of encouraging. And I thought, and he said, and anyway, you're just observing, you're not promoting or whatever it is. So I thought, well, I'd give it a go. So there you go. In those days, you got a ticket to Los Angeles and they gave you a stack of money for expenses and whatever.
Why do you think the BBC was interested in making a film about them, aside from, I think you said that they wanted to work with them at some point, but yeah. Was there anything besides that made them interested?
I think so. Alan Yentob is a very clever guy, as you know, and I think, well, there were two things happening. One is, I think at that time, Canon had just bought the whole ABC cinema chain. Thorn EMI, and they bought the studio that were Elstree, I think, was it? Elstree Studios. Anyway, they bought up the whole lot. So they were like major players suddenly in Britain as well as elsewhere. Also, it looked like they were going to be maybe investing in television. Alan, I suspect, I think he sort of probably said this. I mean, maybe we'll be able to involve Golan and Globus and Canon in co-productions and all the rest of it. Because Alan was always very clever, really brilliant, actually, at bringing co-production money for, say, Arena. you probably know this story, but see, Arena was originally conceived, I think, as a sort of 45-minute studio program with not a very big budget, with a little bit of money for some film inserts, which is what you did. You had a studio-based thing, and then you would do film, it was in those days, film inserts that you'd stick in with interviews that people you couldn't bring to the, or whatever. Now, Alan transformed Arena into this really kind of pretty important series, partly by being very bold about the whole thing. We said, let's forget the studio bit and do them, let's make films and get the best people we can to make them. But also to do that, you need some money. And he was very clever and imaginative about getting money from outside sources. Now, you'd have to check if you're interested in the details. I don't know exactly how it worked. But I do remember, for example, that a guy called Rainer Moritz in Germany put a lot of money into Arenas. And he, I think what happened was he put the money into Arena, which meant that we, the BBC, or Alan, the BBC, and the filmmakers could make these wonderful films with the money that he put in. And Rainer Moritz, I think, got his part of the deal was he got the non-UK distribution rights. I don't know the details, but it's something like that. So this was pretty unusual at that time. So that was very clever. And I imagine that what Alan thought when Golan and Globus cropped up, and he probably didn't know them very well or know too much about them. I guess he met Golan, who was this incredibly charismatic salesman. Maybe Alan had run into them at Cannes and seen them doing, I don't know. Anyway, I think he thought, look, if we go and do, and this does actually bear on a problem that's going to come up, we'll make a film with them and they'll like the film, you know, and all that. And who knows, maybe they'll be interested in doing co-productions with us on other things. So I think that's part of the background.
We'll see how that works out a little bit later. Now, what was your, what were your first impressions of Menachem when you met him?
When I met him?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can remember quite vividly what happened, because I went to the Canon headquarters. They'd moved into this new headquarters in San Vicente Boulevard, I think, in Beverly Hills. And I went to I'd phoned up and they'd said, yeah, okay, come on. And I met someone called, sort of rather sexy PR lady called Priscilla. I think she was called Priscilla, but that might not be right. Anyway, she said, oh, hi, you know, come in, you know, great. And Menachem's in a meeting at the moment, but come on, I'll show you the way to his office. And we went and just take a seat. And I sat down and I was sitting there and people were going backwards and forwards with files and things. And the whole thing looked pretty impressive, you know. Anyway, I could hear in this office, which was Menachem Golan's office, just screaming, people just screaming. And I didn't know whose voice was which, but then the door opened and some guy came out with some scripts or something, I suppose they must have been under his arm, looking like he was in tears. And Golan was walking behind him, shouting at him and saying, and don't ever sort of think you're going to, you know, treat me that way again or whatever. Next, you know, and so on. And Priscilla, who seemed to be around, said, oh, this is the guy from the BBC. And Golan, he wasn't actually very tall, but he was, you know, powerful. I mean, he was like very aggressive and so on. And he said, well, come in, you know, and there were these, it's a bit like a sort of, I imagine, a kind of mafia kind of meeting. There were these guys sort of sitting around behind desks and standing there and standing by the window. And there's about five or six of these characters. And Golan with this big desk, and he sits down behind this big desk. And he says, go on, you know. And I said, well, I'm Chris Sykes. I've come from the BBC to make the omnibus film about you and Cannon. He goes, yeah. And I said, he said, you know, how are you going to do it? Like, you know, like that. And I thought that I might have to persuade him and explain why I wanted to make such a film and, you know, all that. But he didn't seem interested in all that. He just said, well, how do you want to do it? And I have to say, a rather inspired moment, having just seen Delta Force, I said, well, I think the best thing would be if I just followed you around all the time and just shooting from the hip like a sort of commando raid. And he goes, great, yeah, good, Joe, get on with it. You know, where's the camera? Like that, you know, we didn't actually have a cameraman with me yet. So I said, well, he'll be back in an hour or two or something. Anyway, to my astonishment, he just didn't seem to care whether we walked into his office and on his meetings. And, you know, he had meetings in his office, but he also did a lot of stuff on the speakerphone, which from our point of view was brilliant, you know, where he's sort of calling agents, or they're calling him, and he's saying, bring me the script, and guys phoning up and saying, I've got Chuck Norris's latest movie. It's all maiming and killing and shooting, and Golan saying, don't talk about it, bring me the script, you know. So all this, it's just new. One was onto this amazing thing. You couldn't believe. Funnily enough, Aaron Spelling turns up, and this weird thing, they're all trying to eat takeaway chicken off paper plates and so on.
Diet Coke.
Yeah, and Aaron Spelling is really interested, obviously, in the idea of doing business with Golan. Anyway, so there's all this. So here's this larger-than-life figure, apparently allowing us to come in and film everything he's talking about. I mean, I did cross my mind that we might have a bit of a problem with the people's voices. What about the people on the other end of the phone? But somehow that all went away. I don't remember how. Anyway, so there was all that. And you thought, wow, we're really in here. You know, we're really sort of seeing how canon work. Now, it has to be said that it didn't all go very smoothly, because the second day, which was second or third day of following him, it wasn't shot over a very long period, by the way, this film. It was only a few days, I think. But the press showing, whatever it was called, the premiere of Delta Force, what happened was that Golan was doing something or other, and I was standing with the cameraman and the recordist, and we were talking about something, and we realised that there was a guy on the phone next to us, or a woman, I think, at a desk, and I don't know how we knew this, but we realised that what they were talking about was some kind of bomb threat, and the woman called someone or other, and some guys. Oh yeah, the other thing about detail about the Cannon Place, which was rather intriguing, there were these very young, fit guys around who inevitably had gold chains around their necks and hairy chests with Stars of David, you know, and all that. And they were sort of like ex-Mossad guys who were Cannon security. Anyway, two guys came over and she said, look, I've got this guy on the phone. He says there's a bomb in the something cinema or whatever. And I said to the cameraman, let's film it. You know, so he gets filming. And the security guys are saying, what did he say? And, you know, and so there's this one, from my point of view, I thought, terrific scene, you know. They've got a bomb threat to blow up the premiere of Delta Force, you know, presumably from the PLO or someone, I don't know who. So we film all this, and then the whole thing goes on, and Golan comes walking up, and they start talking in Hebrew and goodness knows what. And then Golan turns around and says, you didn't film any of that, did you? And I said, well, we did, yeah. And he said, you don't use that. You destroy all that. I said, look, we can't do that. I mean, you know, you're putting us in a very difficult position. You told me I got freedom to film everything, and the BBC doesn't, a bit naive on my part, I suppose, but the BBC doesn't give up editorial control to anybody. And he said, look, don't fight with me. Just do what I tell you. Don't fight with me. And I thought, no, I suppose I won't really, because obviously if I don't do as he says, when that's the end of the filming. That was what I felt, and I think would have been the case. So we said, okay, we won't, you know, we won't. And actually, I thought, well, is it that important? Anyway, but that was the thing. But this is the sort of thing. So it wasn't exactly clear that we could film absolutely anything. And then later on, for example, there was a revealing sort of incident at the Beverly Hills Hotel where the American film market was on, and that was great for us because, you know, it's where they're selling all the films to Japan and Korea and, you know, Baluchistan and everything, all these ninja films and God knows what, and it provided us with some very good footage to see the Canon sales force at work. But in the course of that, we saw out on a balcony that Menachem and a couple of other people were obviously having some discussion of some kind. So having been told we could film anything, the cameraman, Nigel Walters, and we sort of tracked out, shooting the whole thing without lights and in this sort of verite commando kind of way, as we thought of it. So we go out onto the balcony, and there was a woman sitting there who did look rather alarmed. I didn't recognize her. I didn't know who she was. But she carried on, and they carried on, and Golan was sort of, she was obviously looking for money to finance films. And Menachem was explaining to her why $1 million, which is, she seemed to think was a low-budget amount to be asking for a film. And I shouldn't tell you now, I realised who she was from, I think, because one of the guys said her name, Verity. She was Verity Lambert, who was quite an important producer, you know, at this time doing all very interesting independent films in Britain and obviously looking for financing. And Golan was sort of lecturing on how $1 million, this isn't a low budget, this is a big budget, for $1 million we can make a whole fucking movie and war movie in the Philippines, you know, all this. Anyway, after this, it was great stuff, you know, to see again an insight into Golan. And so we go away, and then this woman came walking up to me, and she said, she looked very concerned about the whole thing, and she said, look, what's going on, what's this for? And I said, well, it's for making a BBC omnibus film. And she said, well, I don't want any of this shown. And again, I thought, well, what can we do about this? I said, well, I don't, you know, we'll have to. And she said, look, who are you making it for? I said, Alan Yentob. And she said, I know Alan, well, I'll talk to him about it. So when I got back to London, this is jumping ahead a bit, Alan said, look, we've got a problem with Verity. And I said, oh, about the pitching meeting. And he said, yeah, she's very, very unhappy about it. She, as I remember this was how it was, she doesn't really want to be seen to be associated with Golan and Globus and Canon, to be doing business with them. So this was a sort of a problem, because obviously the editor and I, and probably Alan too, felt, well, this is a really interesting scene, and it's revealing to show how Canon operate and who they're dealing with and all the rest of it. And we couldn't really see that there was that much to worry about, you know, or that she would have much to worry about. Anyway, Alan's brilliant solution was to dispatch one of his colleagues, who was a guy who obviously knew how to deal with this sort of thing, maybe knew Verity as well. He went off down to Cannes, when I think the Cannes Film Festival was on, and I think the idea was he'd take her out to some really nice restaurant and show her the footage. That's the thing, we put the clip on, he edited just to show, you know, so she could actually see what it was like, and he would, you know, be nice and buy a very nice bottle of wine and show her the footage and explain why he didn't think it was anything she need be upset about. And it worked, and sure enough, she was happy with it. But it just shows the sort of problems with this sort of thing, because Alan at that time was also very close. He was close to David Putnam. Now, at that time, David Putnam, as it happened, was really the only person of any significance who said Canon's arrival in the United Kingdom is not necessarily a very good thing. These, you know, cinema's important, it's about truth and honesty and all the rest of it. And I'm not convinced that these people are the real thing, you know, or whatever. Very, very few people were at that time speaking out and expressing any sort of disapproval of Golan and Globus and their operation. But Putnam was quite bold about it and said, So there was a problem, because I think when we finished the film, Alan, who really liked the film, I mean, apart from anything else, he laughed all the way through it when he came for the... He was the executive, so he came to watch the thing. And I remember him phoning his girlfriend and saying, you've got to get in a taxi and come and see this film because it's so funny. Anyway, the thing was, he also thought that David Putnam might not think it was... He might think it was too favourable to Canon. This is, I think it was the way it went. And that David ought to be in the film. This was the thing. He should be in the film expressing his strong views about Canon's role in British cinema. So the idea is we have to go and film David Putnam. But then the problem was Putnam was quite outspoken. And then Alan was quite worried, or concerned, I suppose it might be called, that Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus might feel, well, this is, well, why are they sticking David Putnam in here to sort of say these, you know, say unfavorable things about it? So therefore the thing was to balance David Putnam with somebody else who would speak someone important, you know. And who could this be? Well, how about Michael Winner,
right? It's funny, because Winner's personality, he strikes me as this, as a Menachem Golan.
Yes.
He struck me as exactly the same kind of person.
They would understand each other very well, yeah. So that's how Michael Winner and David Putnam came to be in the film at the end. I had a certain slight arrogance as filmmaker. I had a bit of an argument about it, and I said I didn't think they should be in the film proper, because it wasn't then like an observational documentary. It was... And I think this, somehow Alan was good about this, and we finished up with some between us, a kind of compromise that I think they appeared after the end credits or something.
They're right at the end.
They're sort of an add-on, like, well, what do you, you know. And, oh, well, I can tell you a funny thing. I don't know about what happened when, because there was, one did have a certain sort of apprehension, one might call it, about what Menachem Golan might think about this film. So what happened was, I think he and Yoram Globus, Cannon had an office in London, and they came over, I think they were probably on their way to the Cannes Film Festival, or on their way back from it, more likely. And they said, they turned up in London and said, we want to see this film, because it was going out, you know, in a week's time or some, or a couple of few days' time. We want to see the film. And so we sent them, what did we do in those days? I suppose we sent a VHS. And waited, you know, and then this phone call came, and someone said, Christopher Sykes, Menachem Golan is sending a car to pick you up, to bring you to Cannon's office in Wardour Street, because he wants to talk to you personally about the film showing. Oh, my God. Anyway, you know, would he think it was as funny as we did? So I got in the car and I went to these offices in Wardour Street, and he was there talking to the press and doing various things. And I think Globus was there. We can come to the question of Globus in a minute, maybe, if it's important. Yeah. I don't know. But Golan, come in. And genius documentary. What can I say? Fantastic. Now listen, I want a copy, a VHS tomorrow, a copy for every MP in the Houses of Parliament. We pay, of course, you know, but I must have them tomorrow. And I thought, he obviously doesn't get it somehow. He obviously thought it was this sort of, well, a wonderful PR piece for Cannon that all MPs would watch and therefore, you know, and support whatever he planned to do in Britain. So I said, well, I'll ask about that. I don't know whether we can do it that fast or quite what the mechanics of this are. But off I went. The film, I think, was shown a couple of days later. And I had to call Menachem, I suppose, about these tapes. And he was absolutely furious. He said, what are these reviews? What are these reviews in the paper? And I particularly remember that Nancy Banks Smith, who was this redoubtable, brilliant, rather brilliant reviewer for The Guardian, who'd been there for years and years, and always wrote very funny reviews, and she'd picked out all the right things about this last Mogul's film and how, what was special and interesting about Menachem Golan. And then she says, and Christopher Sykes had directed and edited it with a sort of a lively sense of irony or something. And Golan said, what is this fucking irony she's talking? That's what I remember, was this great line. And I said, oh, you know, she's a bit sort of, she's a funny old thing, you know, and you know what it is with newspapers. They, you know, well, I remember he was so angry and what am I not understanding here? You know, and I could feel the sort of perspiration running down from my armpits. Anyway, somehow that all went away. They never got the tapes. I think they cancelled the order. Yes, I think after the reviews, they decided they didn't want the tapes anymore.
So it's interesting that he sees the film, he's happy with it, but it's somebody else's commentary that... So he's using the press to translate the film for him.
I guess.
That's fascinating.
One of the things we need to say about Menachem, I mean, he has many good qualities, but I would say that one of his defining characteristics, which was slightly frustrating when it came to doing the last film, was that he had almost zero insight into himself somehow, no sort of self-insight at all. Great belief and artistic longings, which we can talk about and things like that, but I think he simply didn't, he couldn't, he somehow, he sure didn't notice there was anything that funny about the film until it was pointed out.
Right. Right, he doesn't see the folly in what he does. That's okay. He's
maybe I'm wrong, or maybe we're wrong. Maybe the portrait that comes over of him in The Last Mogul's is one that he would be very, very happy with. There's a mover and a shaker who's, you know, getting everybody going, and they're all making films, and John Frankenheimer and Jean-Luc Godard and Norman Mailer, and they're all working, and we're making, you know, maybe it's exactly what he, you know, sort of wanted. I don't know.
No, but the first film, he's not, I mean, he's completely wrong if he thinks that you're presenting him in a favorable light. No. I mean, I don't think it's a hatchet job. I don't think that you eviscerated him, but I don't think that it was, I think the comical part of it, the fact that you present him as a, or the operation as a kind of a funny enterprise, removes any menace from it, which I have this feeling that he might have been menacing if you were a person in the industry, or if you were, let's say, in the British industry, in David Putnam's shoes, and seeing this company of guys who are making this kind of schlock come in and buy up 40% of the market.
Yeah, and that was pretty amazing, wasn't it, what they bought up? Mm. Not that it lasted long. I mean, yeah, and I think one of the criticisms you could make of that film, which I think some people did, was, hey, you know, well, we don't find anything out about Canon finances and everything, which I think are a pretty dark affair. I've never really been that interested in that. Maybe one should be. But journalistically, our film was, I suppose, very lacking. I mean, because where was all this money coming from? Apparently from Dutch banks and God knows what. But that wasn't the sort of film that I was interested in making. I just couldn't believe my luck, you know, in this larger-than-life character, in this extraordinary scene. And there are all these wonderful characters, you know, that were thrown up, like Norman Mailer and Frankenheimer, and all, you know, this is incredible, and here they all are. And Jean-Luc Godard was a slightly different matter, but anyway.
But you made his presence known anyway, which was a nice touch.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember how much we explained what happened in the film, because what really happened was that I would phone people up, the interesting people who were working or involved with Golan, and there was Godard doing, of all things, King Lear, you know, and Norman Mailer, who was very happy to turn up and for a bottle of Black Label Johnny Walker and turn up for an interview and sort of be funny and interesting. And then Jean-Luc Godard, I thought, well, obviously we go and we ring him up. And so I phoned him up, and somehow, I can't remember how, and he said, yeah, okay, I'm in Switzerland at the moment, but I'm going to be in Paris next week and we can meet, and you don't need to bring a crew. He said, I'm really into video at the moment and we can just do it together. And I thought, wow, you know, because he was like a real hero, obviously, for all of us of that. So I thought, this is amazing, you know, I'm going to go to, you know, Paris and interview Godard and we're going to shoot it ourselves, and what a load of fun. So the day before, I phoned and checked that he really was, you know, on for this, and he confirmed it. And then when I got there, I stayed the night, and I went in the morning to this address, and there was a buzzer, an answer phone, which said JLG Films, I think. And there was a card stuck to the buzzer in handwriting, which said, for BBC people, the interview cannot be done, JLG. Well, obviously, I was a bit unhappy about that, and I rang and things, and nothing happened, and I phoned him and nothing happened, and then I waited around, went to a cafe, and I waited around till the early afternoon, and then I went back and waited until someone came out of the door of the building and sort of went in and started working my way up the stairs looking at all the doors until I found one that said JLG Films, and I pressed the bell, and the door opened, and there was my hero, Jean-Luc Godard himself, with some tinted glasses on and one of those papier maïs yellow Gauloise things, or Gitano, whatever, one of the yellow things. And he looked terrible. He just looked absolutely terrible. And he said, what do you want? And I said, well, told him my name. He said, I'm from the BBC and I don't understand. You know, we made this arrangement. He said, well, come in, and he said, I don't know, I've been thinking about this, and I, you know, you're not paying me anything. I said, well, we're not paying anybody anything, it's not that kind of film. And he said, well, you know, what's in it for me? And I actually couldn't think of a very good answer to that, except to say, well, we're interviewing everybody else, and, you know, you're part of the scene. He said, well, I don't know that I'm really that happy to be associated with these people. And of course, in retrospect, I think we know why. Because it was such a mess, the whole thing. So he said, look, I'm really sorry. And then he said, I mean, I'll pay for your hotel and your airfare. And I said, well, of course not, you know.
We haven't talked about Joram Globus. What was your impression of him?
Joram Globus must be a lot smarter than Menachem Golan, because right from the beginning, he kept well clear. I mean, I'm not even sure I had a conversation with him. I think maybe I said hi or something, or he may have said something, but he didn't like it. I don't think he liked it, and I think he sensed that this was not a good thing to have a documentary crew, you know, filming everything that was going on, and, you know, he didn't... as I understood it, Globus was the... And this is at that time, I thought, oh, he must be the financial guy behind all this, who does all that, and Menachem is the sort of the upfront direct. Globus never directed anything, as far as I know. He was a sort of the businessman, and Golan was the sort of flamboyant artist, I suppose. So anyway, I never really got close to him. We filmed a couple of conversations between him and Golan, and there was also a rather wonderful, terrific little scene where Globus was being shown a sort of a box kit of a assault rifle, pistol, dagger, and God knows what, to promote Delta Force.
Merchandising.
That's what it's called. I was trying to think what the word is. Yeah, Delta Force merchandising, the weapon.
Which is hilarious. And it is quite funny. Toys for the Delta Force
toys
for kids.
But that's, so I didn't have much to do with him at all, ever.
Did you get a sense of the dynamic between the two of them?
Not really, no. Only that they had what seemed these hilarious conversations about the titles of films, you know, like Marriage in Venice, Divorce in Venice, Venice...
Stop That Marriage.
Stop That Marriage, yeah, that's right. Good title. You know, that. Yeah. I didn't really know.
You know, I sort of wonder about why Canon ended up being what it was, because it's quite a unique company that produced this unique product. I wonder whether it could have worked had there been two guys like Golan at the top, or two guys like Globus, had it not been the pairing of them, because they seem like very different characters, and the one is definitely a business guy and the other one is definitely this mad artist, but the mad artist was in charge for a while. Yeah. I mean, he could greenlight things and make decisions, and suddenly we have a decade's worth of Canon films.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, you know, disappointingly, I don't think I can tell you that much that's that interesting about all this. I don't know that I was ever that interested in Canon product, or... I mean, I certainly never watched really any of their films except looking for clips, preferably hilarious, to use in the first film. But certainly when I came to do the last film with Golan, you know, then he would talk about this and say, look, you know, we had this conflict between us, Golan and I, you know, and he was interested in the money-making films, the slashers, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas I wanted, and I think this is absolutely true, he did want to nurture these people who made good films like Konchalovsky and Frankenheimer and Godard. You know, he did care about that, I think, in a real way. And he was found himself in conflict over the money with Golan, with Globus. Globus wanted to concentrate on the money-making stuff. And Menachem was, I suppose you could say, almost more romantic about it, about cinema. You know, let's try and make some good films. And the problem is, I don't think he necessarily knew what a good film was. So that, you know, he was interested in these films like Barfly what were the others? Fool for Love. You know, so he was interested in people like Konchalovsky, which Globus, I think, had the business sense to know weren't really going to do anything for them money-wise. And they fell out over this. I don't know whether that was the final falling out, but that would certainly, as Menachem presents it, they came to a bit of an impasse there, and he left. I don't know whether he was sort of fired or what. How did it all work? But all this is details I don't know. I really don't know. I was always much more interested in Menachem as a property, you might say, as a sort of a larger-than-life figure who, filmically, in a way, you just couldn't go wrong with, because all you had to do was, you know, be around him. And he finished up with something really entertaining, and it did also hopefully cast some sort of light on, you know, I don't know, America, cinema, passion for cinema, you know. But he was a funny guy.
This is a message for Mr. Christopher Sykes. This is Menachem Golan calling from Miami. With regard to the commentary on the Versace murder, we agree in principle. We are starting to shoot Saturday the 13th of September. Call me urgently.
One of the key scenes that illustrate to me where his priorities were was when he talks about Cassavetes' film that he's making with John Cassavetes, and he says that Cassavetes turned in a 2-hour and 15-minute cut of the film, and Golan said to him, look, you have to take out 15 minutes of this, and sent him away. And 2 days later, Cassavetes came back with a 2.5-hour film. And he completely laughs it off.
Yes, Golan, it's shorter nevertheless.
Yeah, but Golan is happy about it. Yes, he's happy about this artist having this kind of a flippant attitude towards him.
Yeah.
And he lets the film pass, and he releases it like that, which means that he's on Cassavetes' side. Yeah. And of course, Cassavetes is like a Godard for an entire generation, and I'm sure that
that makes Golan very likable, doesn't it? Very sympathetic, and I think there are other instances of that. Well, I'll tell you the problem, that the second film, shooting Versace, that was pretty straightforward. In other words, it was a bit of a rerun of Last Moguls in the sense that it was pretty obvious what one was doing. I mean, we were going to have a good time seeing this Schlockmeister at work, and my word, isn't it going to be entertaining? You know, that's so... with any luck, that would be the film. And at the same time, it was, I hope, a bit better than that, because you did see, I hope it was a bit sympathetic, because you did see a guy who had apparently some real love of cinema and what he was trying to do, and struggling against, you know, hopeless odds and attack, you know, with a producer who didn't understand movies at all and wanted to make money, I suppose, and working on this pathetic budget and with a time scale that wouldn't allow anything to... and shooting scenes in his motel room because he didn't have the money to do anything else. So it was both funny and, I hope, rather poignant, because you did think, well, now he's a jobbing director, he's just trying to earn some money, but he is working very hard and he shoots very fast, and he does sort of, in a funny sort of way, know what he's doing, at least in terms of shooting sequences and how they're going to edit together. But at the same time, it's rather obvious that he doesn't have... that much artistic talent. And so this was meant to be all sort of funny, and I hope it was. It's worth mentioning that I did, again, slightly to my surprise, I got a fax from Golan after the film. I sent a copy of the film to him and to the producer, Sam Lupowitz, and I got this fax from Golan, who I think now is in Lithuania or somewhere shooting some other movie. And it was really touching, because he said, "Dear Christopher, truly, you are a very great documentarian." You know, I think it said, the words were something like, "You made us look like shit," or idiots. I don't remember. I think he said shits, actually. "You made us look like shits, but it was very funny. You know, and please give my regards to your wife." And so it was quite nice that he sort of recognised and seemed this time to actually see why the thing was funny. But, you know, this is the problem that arose with the last film, which came out of my friend Vitek and I. Vitek, my friend, has a brother in Tel Aviv, and so he was going to see him. And he said, "Look, we were talking one morning, having coffee, and we said, why don't we go and see what Menachem Golan's up to? You know, I'll come with you. We'll go to Israel and see. We'll ring him up or something and see whether he'd like to have lunch." And he was now in his 80s. And I did get, somehow got in touch with Golan, and he said, "Oh, great, yeah, I'd love to see you." And so Vitek and I went round to his place in late morning, and Golan was sitting there with all these scripts and everything all over the table. And he said, "Well, where's the camera?" You know, and I thought we were going to go sort of see what he was up to and all the rest of it. "Where's the camera?" And so I had it. I did take the camera with me. That's right. So we started shooting immediately. And he just seemed to assume right there and then, well, obviously we're making this film about this new movie. I'm making this blockbuster with Al Pacino, I hope. Called Sniper, yeah. And so I started filming, and it was in a way kind of appealing enough to think there's probably a film here about him in his old age. I wasn't really sure, actually, I have to say, but...
So it was a complete accident that the third one came about. Let me just ask you before we get to the third one about shooting Versace. I mean, Golan obviously by this time had figured out that the first film was a little bit of a comedy at his expense. Why would he have you on for the second?
Exactly. Well, I think it was the idea of trying to get me to come and make a film about them making the film. It wasn't Golan's. It was Sam Lupowitz's. Sam Lupowitz was the producer on this thing. He was a very funny guy, I have to say. He told me some of the funniest jokes I've ever heard, but I can't remember any of them. He wanted to get into movies, and he did quite a funny thing, actually. He set up a company called Pan Am Films, and he actually bought the Pan Am name and logo, I think, for $10 at an auction when Pan Am Airline went bust. I don't know whether $10 probably isn't right, but he somehow finished up with this Pan, you know, the famous Pan Am logo. And he was down in Miami, and he did a couple of ultra-low-budget movies with names like Stick Fighter and Stick Fighter 2. And what Lupowitz understood was, and I think maybe Golan did too, was this whole, the future was straight to VHS and sell them in Botswana. You know, the sort of movies, when you go to a video store in Maun in Botswana, what you find is Stick Fighter 3 on the shelf, and you rent it and take it home. So there must have been a time, again, which journalistically would be very interesting to look into, the finances of that whole period which has disappeared, isn't it, of when VHS is all over the world. And this is what Sam saw as a way of making a lot of money. Anyway, he, I think, dreamed up the Versace murder. He'd worked with Golan in some capacity, but I can't remember quite what. Anyway, he'd set up this company, and I think the Versace murder was his idea. And he said to Golan, will you write and direct it? And Golan said, yeah, because he needed to earn some money, I think, or probably also because he wanted to keep making films. So, and it was Lupowitz who said, look, let's get the BBC to make a film about the making of our film, because it'll be really great for publicity. And you know that guy who did a film before. And Menachem phoned me. Lupowitz got Menachem Golan to phone me up and leave this message on an answering machine. I'd just come back from holiday with my wife, and there was this message saying, a message for Christopher Sykes. I remember this, you know, Menachem Golan calling from Miami. You know, we are starting to shoot Monday. Call me urgently, which we put the answer machine message at the beginning of the film, because it's how it all started.
Did he talk to you at all about the implosion of Canon during this shooting Versace film? Did he say anything about that, or his breakup with Yoram?
I don't think so. He was quite arm's length for quite a while. I mean, he wasn't happy to see me, I don't think. When I first turned up, he was saying, Lupowitz thinks this is a good idea. I don't know. I mean, how are you going to be doing this? And I don't know. And when Lottie, who we were an independent production company, Lottie did all the legal and financial side of things. She turned up in Miami, and I introduced her. She'd never met Menachem Golan before, and I said, oh, Menachem, this is my wife, Lottie. And Golan said, has he told you what's going to happen to you and your children if he fucks me? And Lottie said, how do you mean? I mean, he did the other film about you that was marvellous. And Golan said, he fucked me in that film. So obviously by then he'd sort of caught up. Anyway, so he was a bit guarded about the whole thing. And yet, I think he sort of probably liked the attention somehow, and maybe thought it was a good thing. And, you know, we sort of got on. I remember this is an interesting detail in a way, that it was all, I shot it on one of those myself. I'd never shot a film myself completely before, but there were these VX1000 digital cameras that Sony had just brought out, which were stunning, you know, with what they could do and what they could produce, particularly in good light, like there was in Miami and all that. And I remember Golan saying, can I see what, you know, and he came over and played back some stuff on it. And he was looking through the viewfinder and he says, my God, Sam, he says, look at this. We could shoot a whole fucking movie with one of these. You know, he obviously saw the future.
What do we learn about Menachem during this shooting Versace film? What do we learn about this guy?
I think the only thing you can say that you learn from it, the slightly curious thing is that when I came to do the last film, I realized that he actually got quite a lot of money out of when he lit Split and left Canon. I didn't know that. See, I thought when he was doing Shooting Versace, I thought, God, you know, it's come to this. You know, he's having to earn money doing some crap film, you know, and on no money and no budget in order to make a living. Well, obviously that couldn't be quite be right because he did actually have, well, it's complicated in a way. He came away from, he earned a lot at Canon. He came away with quite a bit of money, but I think he gave it all to his three daughters. But no, I would say that what you get from Shooting Versace is this is a guy who really, really has to make movies. You know, that he really is someone who it's his life and he gets off on it. So he, although it must have been to earn money, I would say the main drive for him was probably to be Menachem Golan at work. Menachem Golan director, the guy who could shoot Operation Thunderbolt in 10 days or whatever it was, you know, or 10 weeks from starting to the cinema. And I can only think that he was doing this because this was his what he claims and later claimed when I talked to him more, because in the third film I did really get to talk to him much more intimately about himself and, you know, all the rest of it. I think he really, really was passionate about making films. And it's wonderful in a way. It's romantic that he should have started off as a cinema projectionist in Tiberius. He came from Tiberius and he worked as a projectionist in the cinema there, or assistant projectionist, winding the subtitles for the films. Well, and the fact that he, from then on, his entire life was devoted to films, after all, and doing deals to make films, but you can't deny the fact that that is what he did, and he made it possible for a lot of other people to make films as well. Terrible, most of them, but never mind. But, you know, so I think that's it. I think that's what you see, is this guy, he's willing to go through all sorts of humiliations, you know, and like staying in some terrible, I can't remember what those hotels are called, you know, 5-cent hotels or something.
$30 a night.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, $30 a night and shooting, you know. I mean, this is a guy who's been, as you say, in a big building in Beverly Hills. So, yeah, it's sort of sad, but you could say also somewhat inspiring. And I think, I mean, we had a thing, I remember this rather wonderful idea right at the end of the film, that they had a sort of some kind of rap party, and there's old Menachem, you know, dancing. And I think we ended up with a freeze frame where he looks towards our camera and gives a sort of thumbs up sign, and we freeze frame on that. And I think that was sort of it, is, hey, you know, I'm here and I'm still in action.
There were two things that I got from that film. The first is that, like you say, this is a guy that would be making films forever if he could, and I think that's confirmed in the final movie. And the second one is actually that he's a very, very capable filmmaker. The low budget tricks that he pulls out, you know, he's getting he understands that to have a film you need footage, yeah, right? And if you're missing the shot, it doesn't matter if the rest of the film is great, but you don't have a film.
Yeah.
And he finds solutions, which if you go on low budget filmmaking shoots, you'll find that this finding solutions to problems is the number one priority. And he seems to have a ton of tricks up his sleeve. And he also seems more dedicated than the producer. He just wants to carry on shooting. The producer is worried about lunch.
And I think
the producer, he doesn't quite understand that 10 days is 10 days and we got to get this thing.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right. And I think you could give him anything to direct and he would know about coverage and this and that. And it would all cut together. Mm. You know, a lot of people have absolutely no idea how to do that. He certainly understood all that. And I suppose he learned that pretty early on, probably from Roger Corman. I mean, there's a really interesting story he tells about the wreath that Roger Corman needs for a scene in Young Races, that for the winning driver in a car race, and Golan spends all night really getting this thing.
As a young man,
he meets, a very young man, and working for no money. You know, Corman gives him this job on Young Races, and you know, I think that's pretty amazing, really, the way he said, "I'll do it. I'll get the wreath." You know, not knowing how he was going to do it, but he does get it, and comes back in the morning. He's there on the set, and the wreath is there to shoot the victory scene. And Corman rather wonderfully says, "This guy," he says to everybody, to the crew, "this guy Golan, he's going to be a producer, you know, and I think that's really good.
He says that it's one of the key moments in his life, that moment with Roger Corman, although I get the sense that he embellishes the story just a little bit because he talks about how he spent the whole night working on this reef, and then when you look at the reef, it just looks like something he picked up.
I think
with him is a bit embellished.
I think he probably was the most phenomenal sort of, I won't say liar, but I mean, I think he probably did make up all sorts of stories, and I'm sure he did. Of course he did. He created an image of himself, but somehow he must have learned how to shoot. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff about him that weren't in any of these films, like how he used to work. He worked at the Old Vic in London in theatre with, now you mention it, he says, of course, I was very close. No, I worked with Olivier and all that. So I suppose maybe he didn't really. But he was. He was involved. He did work at the Old Vic, yeah. And he worked on Shakespeare plays, and he worked at the Habima Theatre, which is the national theatre in Tel Aviv. You know, he put the time in learning the craft of all these things and how to deal with actors. But I have to keep coming back to this idea that I think his aesthetic judgment was almost non-existent, except for this one wonderful moment, I thought, in this conversation we had when he was quite old and tired. It's in the third film, when he says that the best film I ever saw was La Strada. And you think, well, you know, if he appreciates La Strada, he's not all bad. I mean, it does mean he does no good film when he sees one.
I was going to say, when you talked about him not having taste, you know, how does one explain his love of directors such as, Barbé Schroeder and Godard and Zaffarelli?
Yeah. I've probably said it wrong. In the way, I suppose what I mean is that
Just the way that he's the product that he creates seems to be tasteless.
When you watch him at work shooting Versace, which I watch for every day for a number of days, watching the performances that he's getting out of actors and what he's asking them to do and so on, and the awful vulgarity of the scenes, both the writing and of the performance, it's just mind blowing. You know, there was a wonderful bit in the script. When I read the script, I thought, oh, I can't wait for this. There was for this moment, and I just must think hard about where the camera should be and make sure I've got the microphone in the right place and all the rest of it, because there was going to be a scene where Franco Nero, who was playing Gianni Versace, has a conversation on a sort of a little bridge thing with his lover, some guy who's Francisco or someone, whatever hell he's called. And in the script, I couldn't believe it. It says, you know, Francisco, but Gianni, you know, you're the kindest man on earth. You sort of love everybody and you're so wonderful or something. And script, Gianni Versace, oh, Francisco, you know, you love to kiss ass or something. Yes, he says, you love to kiss ass. And the other guy says, tell me about it. You know, and you just think, well, how the hell does anybody come up with that? And I thought, well, this is going to be great to see this. But and sure enough, you know, there you see it, and fantastic, Golan, you know, cut, wonderful. And he thought it was just brilliant, and it was so excruciatingly awful. So I suppose what I mean is that he must obviously have had taste, in that he admired John Frankenheimer and Godard and Zeffirelli and these people, and La Strada. But when it came to shooting his own material, I don't think he could... Did he not care or what? No, I just don't think he could see it. I don't think he knew whether it was any good or not.
Now, the first film, I got a sense that you were making fun of him.
Yeah.
The second film, I got a sense that you were still making fun of him, but I got a warm feeling there, like you had grown to like him a little bit.
Yeah. The first film, I thought he was a sort of a monster, you know, of towering, you know, vulgarity and egotism and everything, and he was fair game for us to make look as, you know, funny or whatever as we possibly could. The second film, it's absolutely right. I warmed to him quite a bit, and got some pleasure with the editor out of realizing that we could shape this film into something, I hope, that wasn't just funny about him being this funny character who's, you know, shouting at everybody and all the rest of it, but also slightly poignant in that it's come to this. You know, he wants to make films, but he's having all these problems doing it, and having to work with tiny budgets. And yes, so it's absolutely right. The second film, I hope you both laugh at him and kind of feel affectionate a bit towards him, and maybe admire his stamina. And, you know, he, of course, actually wasn't that old at the time. I thought of him as being old, but I don't any longer. He was in his 60s, I suppose. So yes, I hope. Now, the problem that arose with the last film, and I forgot to mention this, but it dawned on me that the problem with this film was that you couldn't do this anymore. You know, he was too old and too, not sad exactly, because he was still nursing these delusions of grandeur and blockbuster and hiring Pacino or, you know, whoever it was.
Winning
an Oscar, the great, yeah. But you realised that you couldn't do the same trick. You couldn't make fun of him anymore, because it would just be like some horrible film of kicking a man, you know, when he's down. So you couldn't. So that meant one had to transform or turn around. Because when I started doing it, I thought, well, maybe we can have a laugh again at his expense. But of course, it turned out you absolutely couldn't do that. It simply wouldn't work as a film. And therefore, it had to be, if possible, a film about someone that you could like, which is sort of a bit difficult, because, I mean, some people find him really pretty sort of off-putting. I mean, I remember a funny thing. Sam Lupowitz once said, this producer who'd produced the Versace murder, he said to me, you know, Menachem Golan should be kept in a sort of a cage and allowed out once in a while to direct a movie and then put back in again. And there are things he shouldn't be allowed to do in public. I said, like what? And Sam said, well, like eat. And I of course thought of this when I went off for lunch with Menachem when I first started shooting the third film, and he took me to his favourite Yemeni restaurant and ordered these great big burger things, and so it was just unbelievable to see the way he sort of tucked into wolfing all this sort of food. But I mean, so, and he wasn't physically that attractive as a person, obviously, and his personality is very in your face and aggressive and things, isn't it, and rather thing. So there was a bit of a problem with the third film, realizing we couldn't do the same thing again, which was just have a laugh. It would have to be a film where you really cared about the guy, and so we'd have to make it into a film about a man's, you know, artistic longings and yearnings, and which, I mean, I don't think is a misrepresentation, actually. I particularly think of this conversation late on with him, where he'd been out and he got very tired. We'd been out for a walk, and he started talking about his longings for an Oscar. And that's also where he said about La Strada, did you ever see it? It was the most wonderful film, you know. And I thought, this is true. It's, you know, this is fair. He is this guy who's fought all his way from Tiberias, you know, all the way to Hollywood, and now he's still in his 80s. Still trying to make movies, fantasizing about them and longing to make them, and it's okay, you know. It's a story about old age and about dreams, and I hope that's sort of what came out.
Watching the film, and he's talking about how he wishes that he would win an Oscar, it got me to think about the value that canon has added to culture. And now, whatever you want to say about the films, there's no denying that those 10 years worth of films that Golan and Globus knocked out during the 80s, they are endearing and they are kind of revered today by a whole generation of people. People realize it's schlock, But
that's
they
absolutely
love it.
Right. Absolutely right. And I come across it all the time. People say, "Oh, Canon, oh yeah." And you know, when you saw the Canon logo at the beginning of a film, you knew you were in for something kind of...
It will be entertaining or completely crazy, yeah. but you're going to have a good time. Yeah, yeah. It's a beer and pizza movie. Yeah. And I've actually seen another film about them where they discuss how the Canon model, this thing of the business model of selling rights before even making the film, how that's used today, that's mainstream today, how modern action films are actually just big budget versions of Canon films.
Right.
That they are actually, that the Canon films of the 80s have influenced an entire generation of people, both from a business perspective, but also from an aesthetic perspective. Yeah. And I looked up Roger Corman, and you know, he has won an Oscar, like a lifetime achievement. And it got me to think that actually, it wouldn't be completely crazy to give a guy like Menachem Golan a lifetime achievement. He might have made schlock, but who's to judge the value of a film if the aim of a film is to entertain? He's done that.
Yeah.
And if it is to inspire, he's done even that. Maybe he didn't leave you in awe like Fellini or Kubrick.
Yeah.
But
I think this might be absolutely right. And you're in a position to see this. And I suspect I'm probably a bit of a snob or something. I think I maybe don't realise this, just how influential and important these films were to a lot of people. In fact, I had a funny... I've only watched the first episode of The Assassination of Gianni Versace, the BBC series. And watching it, and I had this really funny feeling. I thought, well, it's very like Menachem's Versace murder. It's just that they've got access to the real villa instead of having to build some funny pretend gates, and well, it looks like they have, and they've got these really terrific actors, and they've got you know, loads of money to spend, and they can, and you know, the whole thing's, and better writing, much better writing. But in essence, you know, it's sort of the same. It's just a really, really fancy version of the same thing. But yeah, I mean, I never really got the Canon film. I mean, what I got was how funny Menachem Golan was, and also exciting and inspiring and all that. But I never really, I don't think, got into the Canon films. Although I quite like Bloodsport. I seem to remember I thought that was pretty good.
Have you seen the Mark Hartley film about
Canon? Yes. It's a terribly funny. What's it called? Electric Boogaloo. I thought it was terrific. Yeah, terrific fun. And what I like more about mine was I think it got you closer to Golan, that's all. But I mean, his was very good on Canon, you know, terrifically exciting.
And it wasn't all positive, by the way, there's lots of information in there.
Wonderful stories and very telling stories and so on, yeah.
He finds people who comment on how there were a lot of people in Hollywood that were actually very, very happy when Canon folded. Right, and he talks about how Menachem and Yoram were outsiders, and they were always a little bit looked down upon because they had no class, they had no taste, plus they spoke English in a funny way.
That's a whole really interesting side to the thing, isn't it, actually? Mm. What did everybody else in Hollywood think? And yet, as I say, when I did The Last Moguls, everywhere you went, you know, whether it was Julie Andrews or Alan Bates or Frankenheimer, or as a cameraman, a wonderful cameraman called Alex Thompson, you know, he's saying, hey, these are the only guys who are making the movies, you know. So everybody, apart from David Putnam, was crazy about it because it was work for everybody. And, I mean, of course, I suppose the sort of, you know, what do we call them, the sort of, the gang, you know, whoever they are, you know, the Hollywood elite, I suppose would have had no time for them at all.
And they would have been threatened. I mean, Canon brought jobs to the UK, whereas in Hollywood, I think there was an established industry, and I think Canon were threatening that because they were undercutting. They were making $10 million movies for $1 million.
Yes, absolutely. And they did this very important thing, which, talking about things as you, that they achieved, I mean, the Canon union agreement. I'm not quite sure what it's actually, what the details are, but this was something that Menachem talked about, but it didn't find a place in my last film. But they managed to arrive with the unions at some sort of agreement that for films of below such and such a budget, you know, the crews wouldn't have to travel first class, they wouldn't have to have five drivers, you know, whatever, you know, whatever, there wouldn't have to be a minimum and so on and so on. So it was a very important agreement that the unions and Canon worked out, and it still stands, I believe.
Which means that they've influenced that industry.
Yes.
Which is another reason, I think, yeah. why the industry should recognize them one way or another.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, did you have any contact with Yoram during the making of the last film? Or was
only
there any...
second hand. What happened was that Globus was filming for his film, The Go-Go Boys?
The Go-Go Boys.
Yeah, whatever it's called, The Go-Go Boys. And he was going to be filming interviews with all sorts of people, Canon-type people, actors, writers, everyone. And one of the people he was obviously going to film was his cousin, Menachem. And I was with Menachem at the time when he was supposed to be going to do this filming, and I thought, well, you know, it'd be great if I could go along. Sort of. I didn't really. Menachem was actually the one who said it would be brilliant if you came along and filmed me being interviewed for their film. So I said, well, that would be great. And he had several conversations with Yoram and with Yoram's assistants, saying, can I bring the guy from the BBC along? And they, no, was the answer to that. And actually, and Globus, I think he even says it in the film. Globus was pretty clear, you know, we don't want that guy around. And Golan was saying, I'm going to tell him, you know, that unless you can come along, I'm not going to be in their film. And we had a discussion. I said, well, that's crazy, you know, of course you must go and do it. And it's my decision, he said. But anyway, of course he did go and do the interview with Yoram's lot. And I had nothing to do with Yoram.
Did you get a sense that they'd made up whatever their rift was, or was it
well,
just something for the benefit of this?
I thought it seemed to me there was dirt between them. You know, I don't think I didn't get the impression they were close in any way at all anymore. And he would say, Yoram's a schmuck. And yet, of course, there's this little thing where they both go to Cannes for the premiere of their documentary, The Go-Go Boys. And, you know, there they are together. But I wonder whether they seem to be sort of friendly and everything, but I don't think they...
Tell me, is there anything that we can learn from Menachem? Anything we can learn from him about life and about how to live it? Now that you've known him for 30 plus years.
Yes. I mean, we can't overdo how closely I knew him, but...
But you've seen him at various
Seen him in
phases.
Operation. It's very, very inspiring, isn't it, to see someone want something and go after it and get quite a long way towards achieving it. I mean, it's quite inspiring that he was still talking about Sniper or whatever the new film was going to be in the car on the way home from dinner with one of his daughters, talking to his wife and the daughter who was driving them about the new film. And when he gets out of the car and drops dead, well, I think at 80, however old he was, in not very good physical shape, to be still dreaming of this film and believing it's going to happen and fighting for it at that age, I mean, that says something inspiring about dealing with old age, I guess. The idea that you live your dream, I guess. I mean, he seems to have lived his dream, doesn't he?
He went for it.
Or followed his dream until the last minute. I'm very lucky in that I've met a lot of, all through making documentaries, and I've met a lot of really exceptional people, artists and scientists. I've come in contact with really remarkable talent and really remarkable minds. And one can only say that Menachem isn't really in that class, I don't think. I mean, that was what it made it some, that's what made making the last film rather difficult, is that he couldn't or didn't produce a sort of level of self-insight and self-reflection about his life and everything that one would have made it easier to make a much better film, if you know what I mean. I mean, his talent obviously lies in some other way, maybe the way you've described of creating this very unusual, very special, you know, body of work that has a particular kind of value that isn't the one that we necessarily all value, you know, us artistic snobs. I mean, I can only say, one has to say, Menachem wasn't a vastly talented artist. I mean, really, I suppose it's kind of obvious from the film, but, and it would be wonderful if he was, but I don't think he was. But artistic longings, yeah, he definitely had those. You could say that if I sort of, you could say that Menachem, not really, tragedy is too big and grand a word, but you could say Menachem's, it's to have lifelong artistic longings and almost no artistic talent, and that's a bit of a...
It is a tragedy.
That is a sort of tragedy,
or
isn't it?
Or the thing that he achieved was not perhaps... It didn't scale the heights that he was thinking Fellini, but he ended up Roger Corman.
Yeah.
Maybe that's... Although I don't even know if that's a tragedy.
On the other hand, it's all okay because he didn't realise it. He didn't. He knew he had artistic longings, but he didn't realise that he didn't have artistic talent, I would say.
And I would add that even if his films are not artistically great, they absolutely have a value. And the reason that we are not you and me, but the reason people talk about them today is because there is some kind of a value in sitting down with friends with some beer and some pizza and having a good time.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like I do. I mean, I must say now you've brought all that, you've made me think about this. I mean, I'd say, I feel slightly embarrassed that I probably have adopted a somewhat snobbish kind of elitist position towards Menachem and his oeuvre. I mean, I think there'd be some truth in that. I haven't seen the true greatness of the man.
You will have to watch Delta Force, Life Force, Death Wish 3, and then we can talk about it again.
Yeah.
Thank you for downloading this episode of DogPod. For more information about Christopher Sykes and Menachem Golan and other filmmakers, please visit us at thedogpod.net. We'll leave you today with a clip of Menachem describing his view of cinema back in 1986.
We are like those troubadours in the Middle Ages who used to go to the marketplaces and tell fairy tales, tell stories to the people who had dreary lives. I believe that all of us are looking for, one of the great things that we are all looking for is more life. Life, another life. Life beyond what we are limited to on our earth. Life beyond E.T. Life up there. And that's what cinema provides us. It's practically a godliest art.